Chapter 13. Love and Friendship. Whoever then has knowledge of good things would know how to love them. But how could one who cannot distinguish good things from evil and things indifferent from both have power to love? Epictetus, Discourses, Book 2, Chapter 22. One day, a distraught father came to seek Epictetus's counsel. His daughter was terribly ill, and he simply couldn't stand it any longer. So he ran from the house in pain. "I am so miserable about my poor children that lately when my daughter was ill and was thought to be in danger, I could not bear to be near her, but fled away from her until someone brought me news that she was well." "Well, do you think you were right to do it?" "It was natural. All fathers, or most of us at least, feel like that." Epictetus engaged the distraught father at length because the Stoics made a big deal of following nature, by which, however, they did not mean just doing whatever comes naturally, like leaving your own child in the care of others because you are experiencing too much pain. Epictetus told the man that he didn't deny that many fathers felt like he did, or that it was a natural way for fathers to feel. The question, though, was whether it was right. So he proceeded in classical Socratic fashion. "Was it right, I ask, for you, being affectionately disposed to your child, to run away and leave her? Is her mother not fond of the child?" "She is indeed." "Should the mother then have left her too, or should she not?"
"She should not."
"What of the nurse? Is she fond of the child?"
"She is."
"Ought she then to have left her?"
"By no means."
"Again, is not the child's attendant fond of her?"
"He is."
"Ought he then to have gone away and left her? Was it right that as a consequence the child should be thus left desolate and helpless because of the great affection of you its parents and of those about it, or should die in the hands of those who have no love or care for it?"
"Heaven forbid."
"Tell me, would you have liked, if you were ill, your relations and everyone else, even your wife and children, to show their affection for you in such a way as to leave you alone and desolate?"
"Certainly not."
"Would you pray to be loved by your own people, as to be always left alone by them when you were ill, because of their exceeding affection? Or would you, if it were a question of being left alone, rather pray, supposing that were possible, to have the affection of your enemies?"
You see where this is going.
And yet, many people misunderstand what Epictetus and the Stoics more generally were up to here.
Sure, we can follow his undeniable logic, but isn't he saying that a father's love for his daughter boils down to duty? And isn't that a rather sterile, even inhuman, view of love and affection?
It would be, if that superficial reading of the anecdote reflected what Epictetus actually meant, but it doesn't. Far from it. The point, rather, is that human affection needs to be guided, trained even, by a sound assessment of whatever situation triggers our feelings. It is undeniably true that the father should not have left his daughter just to avoid being in pain himself. This is elegantly shown by Epictetus, both by way of making the parallel between the father and his daughter's other caretakers, in comparison to whom he clearly behaved badly, and by asking the man to consider for a minute whether he himself, had he been in the place of his daughter, would have appreciated similar behavior from a loved one. But that's only half of the Stoic point. There is a difference between what is natural and what is right, and we ought to arrive at correct judgments that will sometimes make us override what is natural in favor of what is right. This point derives from the Stoic theory of oikeiosis, which we have already encountered in the form of Hierocles' widening, or to be precise, contracting, circles of concern. The idea is that we begin life with only instinctual behaviors, some of which are rather selfish, just like the father's natural reaction to his daughter's pain. Once we enter the age of reason in mid-childhood, however, we begin to be able to reflect on things and to separate natural from good when necessary. But this isn't just a matter of letting cold reason take over our emotions. It doesn't work that way, and if the Stoics had really advocated such a simplistic notion, they'd have been really poor psychologists, which they most definitely were not. Epictetus once told his students, "But though we are capable of writing and reading these sentiments,
Though we can praise them as we read, yet they do not bring conviction to us, nor anything like it. Wherefore the proverb about the Lacedaemonians, lions at home, foxes at Ephesus, will fit us too. In the lecture room we are lions, and foxes in the world outside. What he meant was that simply recognizing the truth of something is not enough. You need to practice it, over and over, until you develop a habit that incorporates a rational conclusion into your instinctual repertoire. Think of practicing philosophy in the same way you learn to drive a car, or to kick a soccer ball, or to play the saxophone. Initially, it's all about paying conscious attention to what you're doing and asking why, and as a result, you are pretty bad at it, constantly making mistakes and getting frustrated. But little by little, the repetition of deliberate movements makes your actions more and more automatic, until it becomes second nature to hit the brakes when someone unexpectedly crosses the street, to pass the ball to your teammate who is suddenly unguarded by the other team's defense, or to hit the right sequence of notes at the right pace to produce the melody you want out of your instrument. True philosophy is a matter of a little theory and a lot of practice. We see that the carpenter becomes a carpenter by learning certain things. The helmsman becomes a helmsman by learning certain things. May we, then, infer that in the sphere of conduct, too, it is not enough merely to wish to become good, but one must learn certain things? For it is not arguments that are wanting nowadays. No, the books of the Stoics are full of them. What, then, is the one thing wanting? We want the man who will apply his arguments and bear witness to them by action. Despite Epictetus's right emphasis on practice, the ancient Greeks actually developed a sophisticated theoretical understanding of love, espousing a number of different conceptions of it, some of which are pertinent to the second subject of this chapter, friendship. Typically, scholars distinguish among agape, eros, philia, and storge. Agape refers to the sort of love that you feel for your spouse and children, and that later on Christians associated with God's love for all humanity. As Thomas Aquinas put it, agape is to will the good of another. If you think you know what eros means, you may have to think again. Yes, the word does carry the overt meaning of sensual pleasure and sexual attraction, but as Plato explained in the Symposium, eros develops into an appreciation of the inner beauty of a person, through which we express our admiration for beauty itself, regardless of its specific incarnation. Philia is the dispassionate, virtuous love that we feel for friends, family, and community because we see and treat them as equal to ourselves. Finally, storge, a far less frequently used word, specifically refers to love for your children, but also, interestingly, for your country or sports team. It carries the meaning of an inherently felt love that has nothing to do with reason or reflection. It is hard to deny that the single English word love simply doesn't quite catch all of these nuances, which is unfortunate, since we surely ought to distinguish the love we feel toward our partners, children, and friends from what we feel for, say, our country and God. In all cases, however, the Stoic question would be the very same one that Epictetus posed to the distraught father. It may be natural, but is it right? We are often told, for instance, that we should love our country, right or wrong, or our sports team, regardless of whether they win or lose. I presume that both would be a storge type of love, but a Stoic would argue that loving something, right or wrong, applies differently to the two cases. Indeed, that famous phrase has two sources, one derived from the other, that can be used to see why the Stoics were correct in saying that some kinds of love, the important ones, need to be squared with what is right, not just with our feelings about the matter. The original attribution of the quote is to Stephen Decatur, a U.S. naval officer who allegedly said in an after-dinner toast in 1816, "Our country, in her intercourse with foreign nations, may she always be in the right, but right or wrong, our country." Compare this with the derivative version, attributed to U.S. Secretary of the Interior Carl Schurz, who used it in remarks before the Senate on February 29, 1872. "My country, right or wrong, if right, to be kept right, and if wrong, to be set right. I submit that the Decatur version is more appropriate for a sports team. A.S. Roma, in her intercourse with other teams, may she always be victorious, but winner or loser, A.S. Roma. There is something charming in harmless loyalty to a sports team, regardless, and in fact especially, if they tend to be on the losing side. But blind allegiance to your country can be, and historically has been, countless times, extremely dangerous. Indeed, I'm not aware of whether Schurz ever read Epictetus, but the U.S. Secretary essentially made the same point the philosopher did with the story of the distraught father. Yes, it is understandable and even commendable to have certain natural feelings for our offspring or country. But since we are talking about human beings and foreign policy, respectively, not about sports teams, reason ought to be called in to guide us in our actions. I may feel like fleeing the house because I can't bear to see my daughter in pain, but the right thing to do is to stand by her and support her. I may feel like my country is a crucial part of my identity, which therefore justifies my having special regard for it. But if it is about to engage in actions that are deleterious to itself or to others, then I have a duty to speak out. If something really matters, feelings and reason cannot be decoupled, and the latter promptly ignored. Since friendship is a type of love, according to the Greco-Romans, it is natural that it receives the same Stoic treatment from Epictetus as family relations. For where else is friendship but where faith and honor are, where men give and take what is good and nothing else? But he has paid me attention all this time. Did he not love me? How do you know, slave, whether he has paid you this attention, as a man cleans his boots or tends his beast? How do you know whether, when you have lost your use as a paltry vessel, he will not throw you away like a broken plate? Were not Eteocles and Polynices born of the same mother and the same father? Were they not reared together? Did they not live together, drink together, sleep together, often kiss one another, so that if one had seen them, he would, no doubt, have laughed at the paradoxes of philosophers on friendship? Yet when the bit of meat in the shape of a king's throne fell between them, see what they say. E. Where wilt stand upon the tower? P. Wherefore dost thou ask me this? E. I will face thee then and slay thee. P. I desire thy blood no less. Euripides, The Phoenici, 621. Okay, the master went poetic on me, and besides, Eteocles and Polynices were brothers, not just friends, but his point is well taken. True friendship, like true love, is revealed when the going gets tough, not when things are nice and easy. From a Stoic perspective, friendship, like everything else except our own moral character, is a preferred indifferent. This raises interesting questions, since it means, for instance, that there cannot be any such thing as Stoic friendship between criminals, if criminal refers not just to someone wanted by the law. After all, Nelson Mandela was a criminal from the point of view of the South African apartheid government, but to a person who engages in despicable acts of violence or thievery. This is true not only because it is rather difficult to imagine a virtuous criminal, but also because every time a criminal helps his criminal friend with, say, getting away with escaping justice, he puts his friendship for the other ahead of moral integrity, precisely the reverse of the Stoic set of priorities. The same problem applies to love, both toward our relatives and toward our companion. The world's literature, including Greco-Roman literature, is full of stories of people putting love above everything else, leading on occasion to rather nasty consequences for themselves, the other person, or innocent third parties. But we are often encouraged to admire these individuals because, after all, love conquers all. Besides the fact that love conquers all only in a highly Disney-fied world, the Stoics would simply say that those are not cases of true friendship or true love, precisely because they show friendship and love trumping a person's moral character. We have already encountered Medea, who, before she went completely mad and killed her own children in revenge against her unfaithful husband Jason, betrayed her father and killed her brother in order to help Jason steal the legendary Golden Fleece, allegedly out of love for him. According to the Stoics, whatever it was that Medea felt for Jason, that sentiment wasn't really love. And neither is what is often labeled the same way in plenty of contemporary everyday news stories that are just as horrifying as the ancient tale of Medea. Now, one could reasonably suspect that the Stoics were up to semantic tricks when they maintained that what many people consider friendship or love are in fact no such thing. But that would be to miss the point. The Stoics were both keen observers of human psychology, a descriptive activity, and sophisticated thinkers about human morality, a prescriptive activity. They would have easily granted that Medea felt what is commonly described as love toward Jason, or that, say, two mafia bosses may be friends according to standard parlance. But they would have added, on the strength of their understanding of ethics, that these are the wrong words to describe what is going on in these cases. Why does this matter? Because if we use love and friendship to describe both situations in which morality is trumped and situations in which it is central, then we confuse things by not making semantic distinctions where there are substantive differences. It's just semantics is a weird dismissal of sometimes necessary clarifications of language, because our ability to communicate with and understand each other depends on semantics. That is, on our accurate use of language. Let me give you an example from Aristotle, who was definitely not a Stoic. Seneca, certainly a Stoic, used to help himself to the thoughts of the rival school of Epicurus, arguing that truth is the property of everyone, regardless of where it comes from, so I'm simply following his lead here. Aristotle was arguably a bit obsessed with taxonomies. For instance, he proposed a whopping 12 different types of virtue rather than the Stoics' simple four, even though all types of virtue are really just different aspects of wisdom. When it comes to friendship, Aristotle focused in particular on philia, which we have seen refers to relations not just with those whom we today would call friends, but also with close family. That's why it's not strange that Epictetus brings up the story of the brothers Eteocles and Polynices in his discussion of friendship. Aristotle distinguished among three types of friendship that I think still provide a useful framework today: friendship of utility, friendship of pleasure, and friendship of the good. A friendship of utility is what we nowadays would call an acquaintance based on reciprocal advantage. Say, for instance, your relationship with your favorite hairdresser. My mother used to run a shop for many years in Rome, and it was clear from even a casual observation that her relationship with her clients was not just one of business. These women spent a significant amount of time over prolonged periods of their lives having their hair or other aesthetic work, like nails and such, done by my mother and her assistants. While the work was professionally attended to, there was much talk about all sorts of things, ranging from personal affairs to politics. I don't remember much philosophy being discussed, though. This certainly didn't make my mother a friend of the women in her parlor in the strict sense of the term, but it did make her more than just an anonymous person with whom they simply made business transactions. The ancients' idea was a good one. Even though the relationship is largely based on mutual practical benefit and may terminate as soon as such benefit is exhausted, we still want to behave cordially and have positive social intercourse with other human beings, since it is the right and pleasurable thing to do. Right because we are treating others as ends in themselves, not just as means to our ends, as Kant would have put it, and pleasurable because we are, by nature, social beings who derive satisfaction from talking to other social beings. A friendship of pleasure, the second Aristotelian category of philia, is rather obviously based on, again, reciprocal pleasure. Think of your drinking buddies, or people with whom you share a hobby. Like friendship of utility, this one, too, is based on mutual advantage, only this time, the advantage is not instrumental, but pleasurable. Just as friendships of utility, friendships of pleasure don't need to be deep, though in modern English usage, we would probably deploy the word friend rather than acquaintance in these cases. And of course, like friendships of utility, Friendships of pleasure may also end once the pertinent social glue dissolves. For instance, because we lose interest in a particular hobby, or discover a new watering hole in a different part of town. The third category of Aristotelian friendship goes well beyond the minimal requirements that most people would expect to be met before calling someone a friend. A friendship of the good is that rare phenomenon when two people enjoy each other for their own sake because they find in each other an affinity of character that does not require externalities like a business exchange or a hobby. In those cases, our friends become, as Aristotle famously put it, mirrors to our souls, helping us grow and become better persons just because they care about us. Again, you can see why friendship of the good may refer not just to friendships in the modern sense of the term, but also to relationships with family members or with our companion. Once more, Aristotle was no Stoic, and the Stoics would have said that the only friendship that truly deserves to be called a friendship is that of the good. Crucially, however, they would not have denied either the existence or the importance of the other two classes, but they would have confined them to the category of preferred indifference, things you may very well have and cultivate so long as they don't interfere with your virtues and moral integrity. It is noteworthy that the Greco-Roman categorization of types of love and friendship are not just much richer than our own, but also somewhat differently organized conceptually. They associated aspects of relationships that we keep distinct, as when we differentiate friends of one type from family members of another type from business acquaintances. In the end, concepts and the words that allow us to deploy them are useful insofar as they help us navigate the realities of our world, especially our social environment. But it will come as no surprise to the reader that I admire the ancients' rich vocabulary in this respect, and would suggest that perhaps we lost something significant when we pared down our own language. After all, a meaningfully richer language reflects a more nuanced thinking and a better ability to negotiate existence.